2014 is a year of anniversaries. 25 years since the fall of communism, 15 years since the Czech Republic joined NATO, and 10 years since the country joined the European Union. One Czech politician who was at the centre of all three of these events is Alexander Vondra, who is our guest in today's programme. Born in 1961, the same year as Barack Obama, Vondra belonged to the younger generation of Czech dissidents in the 1980s. In 1989, he was spokesman for Charter 77, and he was briefly imprisoned for his activities as co-author of the influential petition A Few Sentences. During the Velvet Revolution, he was one of the founding members of Civic Forum. He became an advisor on foreign policy to President Havel, and then served as deputy foreign minister. At the time of the Czech Republic's accession to NATO in 1999, he was Czech ambassador to the United States. He organised the NATO summit in Prague in 2002 and then went on to serve as foreign minister, minister for European affairs and defence minister, a post he left in 2012 amid a row over the use of funds for the Czech EU presidency 2 years earlier. Mr. Vondra is unusual in having been a close associate both of President Havel and of his successor and political rival Václav Klaus. He is a member of the right-of-centre Civic Democratic Party, founded by Mr. Klaus. On the 9th of April, I chaired a discussion with Alexander Vondra, hosted by the Václav Havel Library, during which we discussed everything from his impressions of Bill Clinton and the role of President Havel in the enlargement of NATO to the tragic current developments in Ukraine. For the rest of this programme, we'll be broadcasting an edited version of the discussion. I began our conversation with a dispatch sent to Washington from the US Embassy in Prague that was leaked by WikiLeaks. The dispatch describes Vondra as, and I quote, the United States' closest ally on the Czech political scene. So is this an accurate description?
I don't know. It's always difficult to qualify myself. You know, it must be done by the others. But yes, I'm the friend of the United States. I has always been during my entire career because of two things. Primarily, I had a huge admiration for the concept of American freedom, of American republicanism. I loved the United States, so for me, you know, to be there as the ambassador, that was one of the best times in my life. I could find a lot of inspiration. That's very good for somebody, you know, who has raised in this Czech atmosphere of skepticism. So if you come to the United States and see entirely different approach, you know, to almost everything.
The opposite of skepticism, so I mean, also an element of naivety as well.
And it was not just about myself, you know, my three children were growing up there, coming to the first grade, so have seen absolutely different interrelationship, for example, with the teachers. So that was one, you know, love to American way of life. Second, I love the country, you know, it's different. If you, for example, love nature, it's fantastic, you know, to discover the American West, to discover Alaska. And I am deeply convinced that Europeans, and the Czechs in particular, in this salami position between Germany and Russia vitally needs the American presence in Europe and security cooperation. So there was also this political logic behind it.
It sounds quite romantic the way that you're
of course,
painting the picture.
Maybe I don't look like a romantic, but I am a romantic.
And I mean, it's something possibly maybe also goes back to the days of Tomáš Masaryk, the first Czech president whose wife was also from the United States.
His seminal works are full of influences by American philosophy, by American concept of revolution, the Protestant tradition of the American thinking.
Isn't there a problem, I mean, that you can trace back to Masaryk as well, though, that the fact that one thing that the American system of democracy doesn't solve is the problem of nationalities, all living together on the same space, different nationalities, because that's not an American problem. And it seems that it was a problem that Masaryk, between the wars, also was unable to solve, partly because there wasn't really a model to follow.
The American Republic is based primarily on the idea. It was created by the people who were escaping Europe, you know, facing the various types of oppression, the religious or economic poverty or whatever. and escape to the New World to establish something better. It's basically an ideological concept. So United States, it's an entirely different concept than Czech Republic, Germany, France, or whatever.
I mean, you're a member of a political party, the Civic Democratic Party, that is Eurosceptic, and so you don't think that the American model can in some way be imported to Europe?
The United States is not the only ideological project. The European Union is also ideological project. Soviet Union, and don't want to make any kind of parallels here, but it was also an ideological project. That's what the European Union and the United States have in common. And we call themselves the realists, not the skeptics. And the realism means, you know, we can achieve what is possible now, but we should be careful in pushing something into a situation when the general European public is not ready for.
The government that you were a member of under Mirek Topolánek, not only was it Eurosceptic, but Mr. Topolánek was often overtly hostile towards the European Union, even in the language he was using, with that topped up also by the language that President Klaus was using in connection with the European Union,
Klaus,
which is not necessarily very...
I think, speaking about Klaus, it's more difficult, but you should differentiate, you know, there are the various Klaus in the course of time. You know, there was Václav Klaus as a prime minister who signed the application to the European Union. Yeah. There is a Klaus signature. And then there's a current Klaus who even speculated recently, I noticed, that the best way we should do is to leave the European Union, and you cannot find any kind of a statement by the ODS politician. He's not a member of the ODS.
The question I'm asking you more is not a question of the shifts in Klaus's views, but more the idea that how can you constructively move the European Union on when you're at the same time cultivating within the society an idea that the European Union is something unsympathetic to our interests, limiting our sovereignty.
Those who were leaving Europe to build something better in the United States, it took 200 years to get into a consolidated democratic state. There were the wars. There was a civil war in between. It wasn't easy. And the argument here is that the European Union is a very diversified area, full of very diversified societies.
If you compare, for example, the three previous governments in which you served, and the impression, let's say, that they made within the European context, if you compare it with someone like Radek Sikorski today in Poland, it seems poles apart. He's also fairly Eurosceptical. He's also, like you, an Atlanticist, a Euro-Atlanticist, but he has also done a great deal to mend fences, for example, with Germany, and to actually encourage Germany to play a more active role in Europe, which was quite an unusual and quite a brave thing for a Polish statesman to do. And he's done his best as well to cultivate good relations with Russia, which the previous Polish government was far less successful.
Now, look, I know Radek Sikorski very well. We are the friends. I have a lot of admiration. Yes, he had an era of strong Euroscepticism when he was working in the United States. It was the time when I was there as the ambassador. At certain moment, which correlates, I would say, with the appearance of Barack Obama, he maybe has reached the conclusion that we should not anymore rely on the United States, and has made a decision to play the role in the European politics. So he has made a meaningful and, I would say, dramatic shift in his rhetoric. You know, Radek is not an idealist. He accommodates his views and opinions and rhetorics according to what served best to him and to Poland. Maybe, you know, for him it's easier to make this kind of a shift, because to be a Pole, it means that you play the power play. The Czech cannot have this aspiration because of many reasons. You know, you can have this aspiration on the individual basis, but not as a Czech representative, because you will not find a support in the nation. But suddenly, the Poles, one of the differences between the Czechs and Poles is that the ability of Poles to keep together. I could observe this, you know, even outside of Europe, in the United States, when we are lobbying for NATO enlargement. For Poles, it was easy because they stay together, trade unions, Polish-American organization. The Czechs are very individualistic. You know, our contribution to the success of the NATO enlargement was that we have the individuals like Havel. We brought Havel. They brought the Polish community. You know, they did not bring Valenza.
I'd like to ask you about your time when you were Czech ambassador in Washington, which was at the time of the Clinton administration.
Yeah.
And what were your impressions of Clinton? Because you must have come to meet him on several occasions. He was president when the Czech Republic joined NATO. It was also the very same time when he led the controversial, and in this country, highly controversial, bombing of Yugoslavia. What were your impressions of him?
To put this simply, very good impression. He was a great president. Maybe, you know, he was not a major thinker, but he was a man who first listened to the others, and second was open-minded in his concept, so he was able to respond to what he has heard. Mm-hmm. And last but not least, that's important in the politics, he had a charisma. So you could disagree with him on some issues, and I'm not a Democrat, so, you know, I would find the areas where I would disagree with him. But quite often I have seen that the people who were opposing him were suddenly almost defenseless because of the energy of this special charisma. And he has an achievement, in particular with Europe. This idea of NATO enlargement, I think he should be credited because he made a decision against the bureaucracy which was subordinated to him. He made a decision in response to the tragic events in Bosnia and Herzegovina. And secondly, he was able to work together with the Republicans and thus achieved kind of a consensus within the American
Václav Havel was a very significant figure representing this country
absolutely,
in the eyes of America.
Absolutely, the most important, yeah. And we should thank him forever for his role, because he has something similar with Clinton, this ability to listen and to react to the situation.
At that time, Mr. Klaus, who was chairman of the House of Deputies, he was opposed to the bombing of Yugoslavia and to the intervention in Kosovo.
Klaus internally, I would say, inside his soul, was even against the NATO enlargement.
Why then? Why was he opposed?
I think intellectually he's something like a libertarian. It's a strict economic liberal which does not believe in the role of state, and the security issues are almost irrelevant. It's a free trade, free trade, free trade. You know, I do not like Obama. I think he is a catastrophe for Europe. I do not see any leadership. I do not see any knowledge about European history. His niveau is from entirely different corners of the world. Clinton has understood. But, for example, to imagine that the president of the United States will be Ron Paul or his son Randy Paul as a representative of this libertarian thinking, that would be even worse for us. He would lead the United States to the total isolationism, ignoring the world role at all. And this is something for small countries like us. It is not good.
I mean, very famously, just before becoming president, in fact, 2 weeks before becoming president, Václav Havel called for the dissolution of all the different blocs, the Warsaw Pact, which of course happened, and also NATO. Do you remember at that time talking with Havel about it, and whether you argued with him, or at that time did you disagree with him?
I think it's a myth that he would take a policy of the equidistance towards the Warsaw Pact and NATO.
He did say it was on the 16th of December, 89, just before the time.
But I think once he became the president, he was feeling more and more responsible. Second, you have to understand that there was also certain tactics, because the primary goal of Czechoslovak at that time, government and diplomacy, was to get rid of the Russian troops outside of the territory here, to become the really independent state. And Certainly, you know, to provoke with, you know, NATO membership, it would not be the best recipe how to achieve this primary goal. But Havel was the first statesman from Central and Eastern Europe who showed up in the headquarters of the North Atlantic Alliance. It was in March 1991, and openly declared that NATO should open the door for the others.
Havel was consistently the most sort of interventionist politician during the Yugoslav wars as well, wasn't he, on the Czech political scene?
Havel did not so much provoke, for example, the countries like Slovenia and Croatia to go a separate way. But once did it happen, and once the war has broken out, Havel was the one who strongly advocated the West should do something to stop the war and to protect the people and their freedom. That's certainly true, and here he has a different political concept, different opinions from, for example, Dinsmier or Klaus, who were on the same board.
And at the time of the first Klaus government, when you were one of the deputy foreign ministers, were you playing a role of mediator between these different forces?
If you ask me, yes, look, you know, we had President Václav Havel, we had Prime Minister Václav Klaus, you know, on some issues they were like day and night or sun and moon, and we were responsible for the foreign policy of the country, which, you know, if you have a big power, you can have different views. A smaller country, you have to follow one road.
Klaus was very much representing the party political model, wasn't he? And Havel was the more, let's say, individualist or individual responsibility model.
I don't agree that this was a major disagreement. You know, Havel has perfectly understood that the normal standard democracy is not viable without the political parties. That's an anarchy. So he perfectly understood the role of the political parties, so he disliked Klaus, that's for sure. But at the same time, he understood that the parties must play the role, and Klaus' role was that he was the builder of one of the two major political parties. So both had to be somehow realists, despite all the disagreements. But the real disagreements were about real things, you know. For example, Yugoslavia, for example, you know, something in the economy. So those fights were about very particular issues. Yes, Havel had a strong opinion that in democracy, the civic initiative, the role of the NGOs is crucial. Klaus has opposed.
Where do you stand?
Of course, we need a civil society. Without a civil society, without the NGOs, the political parties cannot exist. On the other hand, I agree with Klaus that you need the political parties. Mm. Otherwise, it's an anarchy. And
what do you think that somebody like Mr. Babiš, who is now the finance minister, who is not a party man, and he's a magnate, a multimillionaire, do you think that's dangerous?
I think it's very dangerous. I think that we are the most dangerous moment in the last 25 years, because it's not a political party. It's a private project of one man who has billions of money and owns the mainstream media.
Why is it happening? It's a trend everywhere in Europe. I mean, you only have to look at countries like Italy, for example.
The trend is that there is a certain mistrust towards traditional political parties. You could see this in Italy, you could see this in Netherlands, in France or elsewhere. But never you could see a role like a Babiš. Berlusconi was not the same type.
Why? Why?
For example, the media. He had two entertainment channels, while Babiš has the ownership of the mainstream media. Those who are leading in opinion making, so they have a direct impact on the political scene. That was not the story of Silvio Berlusconi.
Because, I mean, do you think that the Prime Minister, Mr. Sobotka, is strong enough to be accountable?
I'm afraid that he's very weak, and we can see this every day, that he's not able to counter him, and it's very dangerous.
For 2 years, you were Defence Minister of the Czech Republic.
Yes.
I remember the statement you gave when you first became minister in 2010. You said, I want an army which has less fat, more muscle. To what extent did you actually succeed in at least beginning that process?
With a much lower budget, we were able to honor all our real commitments. So the number of the troops in Afghanistan has grown up, even, you know, in 2010-11. Now, of course, it's being decreased because everybody is decreasing. We are leaving, you know, in general.
And the ministry was in a total mess when you inherited it. I mean, I think that, I don't know whether even you would acknowledge that, but certainly, I mean, I remember speaking to one diplomat from a NATO country who said that of all the new members of the European Union, the new members of NATO that he works with, the Czech defence ministry was one of the most opaque. This was just about the time when you became minister.
I would differentiate between the armed forces on one hand and the ministry.
You were the head of the ministry, so...
We reduced the number of the bureaucrats, we have reduced the number of the departments, so we have rationalized the ministry itself, and it's in fact a never-ending story, so you could continue in that. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, the Czech soldiers... I have nothing wrong to say about them. They are fantastic. Those are totally different soldiers compared with 20 years ago.
I mean, what sort of Czech army can be useful to NATO today?
We are facing new Russian expansionism, no doubts about this, so should concentrate on the defense of the territory, because, you know, this Ukrainian destabilization could spill over into the Baltic states, for example. Latvia has a large Russian minority, and we have a commitment to defend Latvia. We don't have a legal commitment to defend Ukraine, but we do have a commitment to defend Romania, we do have a commitment to defend Latvia, Estonia and Lithuania, and we do have a commitment to defend Poland.
So are you actually suggesting that at this stage that NATO should be deploying troops on the eastern borders of NATO?
Yes, I think we should seriously think, for example, about a stable air defense protection, because right now they don't have any supersonic aircraft. So, yes, I think the West must react to what's happened with the Ukraine.
In a recent article that you wrote, you stated that NATO should start measuring Russia by the same yardstick that Russia is measuring other countries. That argument strikes you as being slightly flawed, because...
Why?
Because it implies that we should pull ourselves down to the level at which Putin is currently defying international...
I am not suggesting
a kind of tit-for-tat approach.
No, I'm not recommending the eye for eye. That's certainly not the case. However, I'm warning, you know, to get rid of a certain illusions, you know, here. Those things which happens now, I think, should lead us to a certain realism. First of all, we should take the duties which we are willing to bear and must do everything to protect them.
President Zeman on Sunday said that if Russia goes any further into Ukraine, into eastern Ukraine, that NATO should offer direct military support to Ukraine. Would you agree with him on that? And I mean, do you think this... I mean, it strikes me as being... Whether you agree or not, it's not going to happen, is it?
It's a nice statement. I love the statement, but we should not measure this by statement, by the will to act. And if there is a not will to act, and I think it's not upon Miloš Zeman, then we should be careful. It's a tough situation. It's a tough situation.
What should we do?
Minimal program is to defend the NATO members. I have spent a lot of time with the Ukrainians in 2004. I have visited Ukraine, Kiev, but also other destinations, maybe 10 times in a year. I was helping Yushchenko when they were getting ready for the elections. Then the elections were stolen, so it caused the Orange Revolution. Again, I was coming there, helping them. They have got some chance, you know. I don't want to criticize them because it's difficult. You cannot expect a miracle to happen in the course of 3-4 years. And a lot has changed in 2008. Until 2008, the West was somehow on the offensive, setting up the agenda, and the Russians were mostly reacting on it. But since 2008, you know, the economic crisis came, which has led both Americans and Europeans to be really inward-looking. There was this fight for Lisbon Treaty after the Irish referendum. So the Europeans have spent everything, you know, just to protect the Eurozone, debt crisis. And we are starting to lose the East, part of that. The Ukrainians and the Georgians were coming to Bucharest NATO summit in the spring 2008, getting ready, you know, to enter into the so-called membership action plan. But the Germans, the French did not want to offer the guarantees to those two countries. And then Putin has translated this, that he has a green light. So that's how the war in Georgia started. It was easy for him, you know, small country. So he grabbed it for one quarter of territory. He started to press the Ukrainian government, so raising the prices of oil, and mostly the gas, because
that's what oil was. But what should we do now? That's more the question. I mean, that's the mistakes that were made in the past.
I don't have any miracle prescription here. Mm-hmm. I spent last month 3 days in Brussels. I talked with Rasmussen, with a lot of Americans, Germans. There was an Italian foreign minister. And on the question which you asked me, she was asked the same question. And her response was, oh gosh, wow, we cannot go to war. Or do you want us to go? So that's where we are now.
You've been listening to an edited version of my talk with Alexander Vondra at the Václav Havel Library on the 9th of April. For the full version of the interview, go to the Václav Havel Library website, www.václavhavel.org.